We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight, Catherine is going to introduce our speaker.
Thanks, Jackie. My name is Catherine Wood, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And it's really a privilege for me tonight to introduce the speaker who just so happens to be my husband. So if I wanted to say anything bad about him, I couldn't if I wanted to. But there isn't really anything bad to say, and I can tell you that because I know him better than anybody in the world other than his son and our children. And when I met Marty Wood, I had been through some tough spots in my recovery as far as a relationship, and Marty knew that, and he said to me, I'm going to have to just tell on him for a minute. He said to me, you know, I can tell you every day how much I love you and how trustworthy I am, but I'm just going to have to show you. And he has shown me every day since I met him. And what I can tell you about Marty as a partner is that he is kind and loving and respectful and trustworthy. And I knew very quickly in our relationship, and certainly have learned in our marriage, that he is a man who walks in the principles of this program. And he is a loyal and faithful friend. He sponsors men. He works closely with his own sponsor. The gifts that he has earned from this program continue to affect our whole family. He is the greatest man that I have ever known, that I've ever met, and it's an honor to be his wife. And it's a privilege and an honor to walk this journey of recovery with him. And with that, I give you Marty Wood.
Wow. Not too long ago, I sure didn't deserve an introduction like that. I'm Marty Wood. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. My sobriety date is April 1st, 2011. And, you know, every time I come here or to any AA clubhouse, I always feel at home. And it was not too long ago that I didn't have anywhere to call home. And, you know, I'd like to thank Nav and his clubhouse. I'd like to thank Tim Ridgeway for asking me to get up here tonight. And thank Jackie for your service. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you guys giving me the chance to share my experience, strength, and hope, and what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I'm going to start off, and I was born in California, Van Nuys, California. And I come from a family, a dad and mother that were pretty normal people. I have a sibling, a sister, who's 3 years younger than me, and I lived in California until I was about 8 years old. My dad was just a normal, everyday guy. It was a white picket fence family. We had a dog, a two-car garage, and a house, and we went to school every day, and we were fed extremely well, and I thought everything was very, very normal as far as my childhood goes. We moved when I was 8 years old to Brentwood, Tennessee, and that's where I really call home. And I lived there for about 25 years. And for you Georgia fans, I'll talk a little bit about Tennessee real quick. I was deep blooded Tennessee, and they got it saying, you know, there's a big reason they chose orange for the color in University of Tennessee, and that reason is they could get up and go hunting in the morning. And they could go to the ball game in the afternoon, and they could go to jail that evening without changing colors. You know, and I always caught along to that. You know, and I'm spent my many a time in orange in Knoxville. I always call that home, and that's where my family grew. Basically, I grew up with my sibling, and I can say that my dad was, I idolized my father when I was growing up. I idolized him, and I idolized his work ethic. I idolized the man he was and the word that he gave me. And he put, baseball in my hand at an early age, probably 2-3 years old. I remember having a glove in my hand, a ball in my hand. And my dad grew up coaching me all the way till I was 15. But one of those things through that normal childhood happened in Alexandria, Louisiana. We were playing in the World Series, and I get to this point of telling you, my dad. I idolized my father. I idolized my childhood. I grew up very, very normal. Neither one of my parents drank, and I didn't know anybody in my family that drank. And so I tell you that is my dad was a coach, and we went to the World Series in Alexandria, Louisiana, and I had been gifted as far as my ability to play baseball. And I was very blessed as far as my athletic ability. But that morning we had won the game previously, and that morning we got out that day, and my dad was hitting grounders to us. And you know, if you guys ever played baseball, you remember that the grass gets really got a little dew on it in the morning, and my dad's hitting grounders like pros hit grounders to somebody, and I caught about two off the lip that morning. And I started getting extremely worried that evening when we were going to play one of the top teams from Mississippi, and rightfully so. They were really strong, and I proceeded to make about six errors at shortstop, just flagging ground balls, just something that was very gun-shy at the time. And I get home to that dormitory, and there was 18, 20 kids in that dormitory, and I remember my dad calling me in there, and a lot of you guys were raised by a firm hand, and this wasn't the firm hand coming from my father. This was a beating that I didn't deserve. And that I thoroughly had the hardest time telling you guys right now, and I had the hardest time talking about that for years. And I took a beating that took my that altered the way I was on the inside. It altered the way I felt about myself. About I idolized my father, and that self-worth of anything about me was gone. I felt worthless, and quite frankly, didn't have any self-esteem built in my body at all after that was done. And I keep remembering back, I had a real, real promising career as an athlete, but I remember that feeling of being not worth crap because I lost trust in a man that I trusted all my life. From that point forward, I kind of existed through, and my baseball talent kept me tied to something besides drugs and alcohol. But when I was 17 years old, I was a junior in high school, I remember taking my first drink. And I can tell you this, I knew I had arrived, and I knew that something was different about that first drink. And that's where I wanted to stay. That's where I wanted to stay. Somehow baseball tied me into being... having that of a commitment. And I had a commitment to baseball, and it was my ticket away from my dad. And so I kept pursuing my baseball career as I kept pursuing my drinking career on the weekends. And my drinking career escalated, but I was still a weekend warrior. And I got a scholarship to a Nazarene college that they were going to let me hit and pitch, and I ended up going there. And that's when that drinking... I knew that I drank different than that normal drinker in college. I knew deep down inside I didn't drink like the next guy. You know, I'd have 10 beers before I met my buddies to go out. I knew I drank differently. And that's when, the other mind-altering substances came into my life as well. You know, I started partying, doing cocaine on the weekends. I was a drug addict, but what you got? What do you got? Because I'm in. And, that proceeded to keep me tied into that until I was 29 years old. Just a weekend warrior, party on the weekends, but that I'd always had to control it, but I always had to rely on that baseball. I always had something to go back on. And so in 29, at age 29, I'm going to move forward a little bit, and I started – My baseball career, I ended up playing some semi-pro ball, some pro ball for a little while, and that career ended when I tore my rotator cuff, and I was 29 years old, and that meant that I had to go out and get a real job, and I had to get in the reality of things of I can't rely on baseball anymore, but I don't want to see my father ever again or talk to him ever again, so how am I going to escape from that and work? And so I kept on in my job. I found a job that it's the same business I'm in today in the credit card processing industry. And I pursued the career of drinking and drugging to another level at the age of 29. And that started to my downfall as far as being able to get a grip on my drinking and drugging. But I always, and I've heard a guy explain it like this, my bottoms were always like this because they were kind of semi-bottoms because I always got reeled back in because of that job. And I always had to have money because I always wanted to do the greatest drugs. And I always had to keep my work ethic up because I idolized my father deep down back in my mind. I idolized his work ethic. So I always tried to keep it together to some extent. And in 2000, in the year 2000, I lost all control of my alcohol and drug addiction, and I started entering the world of treatment centers. And my years of treatment centers started in the year 2000. And I went through 7 treatment centers and 3 detox centers. I got 3 ex-wives, and I've got 2 kids. And my drug addiction and alcoholism take full force on what happened through those years. Because I didn't know, or any reason that I ever got married wasn't the right reason. It wasn't the right reason. I was looking for something to fill that hole, and I couldn't find, I didn't have a solution. I had no sufficient solution. My solution was drugs and alcohol. And so in 2000, around 2009, I was going through my last divorce, and I had been through the ringer with her. We had gone, and I was living in separate places. I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, and it talks about in the book where it says you can either go to the bitter end or you can accept spiritual help. Well, when I decided to go, 2 years later, in 2011, I decided to move to Atlanta, Georgia, and it was to go to the bitter end. I had made up my mind. I had met some people through the 2 years of me discombobulating in Knoxville in business. I had met some people that drank and drugged like I did down here. And those are the people I wanted to hang out with because they didn't judge me. They didn't care. They knew that I drank like them, and I knew I drank like them, and so I was coming down here to not only do that, to move a little extra weight, if you know what I'm talking about. And I started getting in the other type of business. And, you know, when I say that that time, I didn't know, you know, it talks about the difference from the truth and the false. I didn't know what that looked like because I lived simply you can say I lived to use and used to live. And that's exactly what I did the whole time. And when I got here on March 15th of 2011, I called my boss, and he's out of Dallas, Texas. And I said, you know, Comcast is having a little trouble hooking up my internet. They're having a little trouble this and that. You know, it's going to be 2 weeks before they can hook my business system up, which was the truth. And my boss said, well, you've been working an awful lot. You need a 2-week vacation. And that's all I needed to hear to go on a big run. You know, a big run. So I took that from where I was in March 15th of 2011. And for 9 days, for about 9 or 10 days, I isolated in my condo at Sandy Springs and drank 2 half gallons a day and then about 3 8-balls a day. And that's how I drank and drugged. I didn't want anybody around, and I didn't want anybody to get my dope, because I wanted the only dope that was there, and I didn't want you to share it with you. And I didn't want anybody to get into my drinking or anybody to look at me any differently. But I knew that I was getting a little nervous about my drinking, because I couldn't make it to the... I'd get the taxi driver to come pick me up to take me to the liquor store. And I'd get the taxi driver to sign my debit card, because I couldn't punch in the PIN number, I was shaking so bad. Couldn't sign as a credit and couldn't punch in for a debit. Now, for that alcoholic, that's not a good deal. Because somebody's got to sign your check. And I just remember that last bit of my drinking. Couldn't hold that jug quick enough. I'd lose the first half a fifth in the sink because it was coming back up. So I couldn't keep it down. Trying to get that first drink down so I could feel better. But guess what? Never felt better. It stopped working. Stopped working. Alcohol and drugs took me to a height that I always wanted to be at, but I always wanted to be on that medium high, like a dryer setting, and I was always overshooting the mark. You know, I was either too high or too low. I couldn't get that medium high just right, you know. Couldn't get it dialed in. Well, I tried numerous times, because I wouldn't go anywhere. Once I started catching a little buzz, I didn't want to go down. I wanted to go up. I wanted to go up. You know, and when I talk about treatment centers, you guys, I want to say one thing. God bless them. God bless treatment centers and the people that get it in there, because those guys don't get paid near enough what they need to be paid. And those counselors and those psychiatrists and doctors, I'm going to tell you, through my journey, I'm going to steal a line from a guy that I heard the other night. And all treatment centers did with me was fatten me up for another run. That's all they did for me. Because I wasn't ready to hear what I needed to hear. I always had that lurking notion that I could go back out there and drink like normal people. One more time. One more time. So I started feeling better with the physical. I didn't know anything about the spiritual or the mental side. All I knew was I started feeling better. And it was time that I could go back out there and drink again. Like a gentleman. Like a gentleman. So when the last drink that I had, March 30th, 2011, they put me, they found me face down, planted, face down outside my condo. Sandy Springs Fire Department, about three, you know, of those guys in nice handcuffs came to see me. And I don't remember, but all I ended up is showing up in North Fulton, and I do remember that. Blood pressure was probably 220 over 150. I was 375 pounds, and I was a hot mess. And I looked everywhere for a bed, for a treatment center, for anybody that'd take me, because I didn't want to quit drinking. I didn't want to quit. When I came in there for 2 days and started coughing up blood, I mean, it was just nasty. The whole 2 days I spent in there. My cell phone was dead. Nobody knew I was. All the friends who now are frenemies, they don't ever show up in those places. You know, I have nobody that knows me now. You know, when I'm at the North Fulton Hospital, I came down here with my drinking buddies, but nobody showed up to the hospital. So I saw the white light in the hospital, and it wasn't these white lights, and it wasn't the surgery white lights. I saw the white lights because I was ready to go. I was ready to die. I wanted to die because my life sucked so bad that I was ready to die. I was prepared for that. And by the grace of God, I'm standing here today in front of you guys. Because my God and my understanding had different plans that day. And what happened was there wasn't any beds. At least that's what the doctors told me, because I bugged the hell out of them. There wasn't any beds available, and I knew I had to go home. But if I knew I went home, it was going to be a bad scene, because there was a lot of cocaine there, and there was a lot of liquor there. So one of these angels that's not one of us came to the hospital and cleaned up my condo from top to bottom before I came home at night. I came home at night and knew I had to do something different. I went to the Alpharetta group and picked up a white chip. I knew when I picked up that white chip, that was probably my 15th, 20th one. I don't know. I could tile a nice little bathroom floor with my white chips. But I never, you know, they talk about relapse, you know, and all that kind of stuff in here. You know, I never did relapse because I never did do the work. You know, I never did do the work. So when I came in, I knew I had to do something different. But my biggest struggle was I'm not going to trust another man, because I didn't trust my dad. And everybody let me down all around me, so my trust was gone. So what I knew I had to do, and it's not the meetings you make, it's the steps you take, but I had to go to meetings. I had to go to meetings. I went to 205 meetings in 90 days, because all I was is hanging on by a thread. And I got a sponsor about 18 days in to my journey. And I was hesitant to ask somebody to be my sponsor. There we go back again with my dad. And I don't want to talk about it with anybody. Never have I shared it with anybody, or am I going to be free of that? I'm going to take that shit to the grave with me. Because not only did it happen when I was 14, it happened again when I was 18. So, got two different cases there, and I'm asking somebody to be my sponsor, and God brought me to him. You know, I can say that, and I didn't even have a relationship with God at the time. But God brought me to my sponsor. Because my sponsor, first thing he did was took me, he says, we're going to meet on Friday at 4:30. I'll never forget it. It was the 20th day I was sober, and he took me to page 30 of the big book. And he said, read that for me. I mean, I had always conceded was a big word for me, because I had never conceded to an athlete. Was like, I got to throw the white flag up. I ain't doing that. But I had surrendered, and I had to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict, deep down inside. And that delusion that I presently may be, or may be like somebody else out there, had to be smashed. And that was the first step of recovery. And that line in the big book I go back to all the time, which is one of my favorite lines. Because that delusion kept me out there during that treatment center and doing out there all those runs, because I knew I could go back out there and drink like normal people. There's no disease going to whip my butt like that. No disease. And I didn't even know it was a disease. I didn't even hear that in treatment. Because I stayed out on the front porch and smoked a lot of cigarettes. Took a lot of laughs then. You know, when they told me to go to group, I went to group. But I made sure I was well medicated. So when I get back to, when my sponsor took me there, he said, you know, I need to meet with you frequently, and we need to go through this work quickly. And you know, I needed a solution that was sufficient to drugs and alcohol, because drugs and alcohol weren't my problem, they were my solution. So I needed something sufficient. I needed something I could hold on to. And I knew by keeping tight, close to meetings, I was calling my sponsor every day. I was reaching out to 10 people in my network all the time to try to reach out to a different person. My sponsor said, get two numbers every time you go to a meeting, different guys. So I kept doing that and doing exactly what he had, because my way of thinking didn't work for 30 years. So I knew I had to do everything different. So this is where the story starts getting a little good to me. Because this is where I start going through the steps, doing work. Because the solution's in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, 1 through 164. Blank page through 164. That's the solution today. And so I started going into step two. And the biggest thing about step two, because you guys know I went to Trevecca Nazarene College. My mom was Mormon. My dad was Baptist. And I went to a Nazarene college. And that was pretty screwed up, little religious background. So my God, my understanding was a judgment was harmful, didn't like me, hated me, was going to punish me the rest of my life for the sins that I had committed. That's what I thought. When it talks about in the book that I could build my own conception of God, that's when I hooked up to that. Could build my own conception of God. And you know, from there I went into step three and to turn my will, my life over the care of God as I understand Him. My thoughts and my actions, I didn't understand that. My will and my life. I've never heard my will all my life. I've ran on self-will. I didn't know what turning my thoughts and my actions over to care of God. When I did 4 and 5, that's where the dope is. That's where the good stuff is. That's where you start really getting free. You know, I started doing the work and started digging down deep. And those things that I talk about that I'd never share with somebody else, I shared because I got through with my fifth step. And my sponsor said, now tell me 3 things you hadn't told me. You know? And I had to get honest. And I did 6 and 7. And 6 and 7 is not much in the book about 6 and 7, but I was ready for him to remove those character defects. And I did 6 and 7, that work in the 12 and 12. They talk about in 7, it talks about the chief activator of our character defects, self-centered fear. And those, because I think I'll get this right, you guys. I always wanted it's what I demanded that I didn't have and something that I thought I was going to lose. I lived that way all my life because I lived in that fear my life that I was going to lose something or lose something I'd already demanded that I wasn't going to get. But when I started doing 8 and 9, and I'm going to talk about my kids in a minute with you guys, and when I started doing 8 and 9, you know, that's my sponsor said to me, you know, because I didn't know if I wanted to go back and revisit, see my kids. I was an absent father for 10 years. Drinking and drugging meant more to me than my kids did. My ex-wives, that was alcohol and drugs was my master for a long, long time. I thought it may have been easier to sweep my kids under the rug. Forget about that. Finish the steps, but I'm going to forget about my kids. They just don't know where I'm at. They have no clue where I'm at. But I wanted something different. I wanted to be free. And my sponsor said, how free do you want to be? So I started going back and doing the work. And I went to revisit my son. It sits right here on this front row with me today. My oldest one's 20. He's at the University of Tennessee. Made amends to all my ex-wives. We're friends today. Communicate today. Made amends to my mom. Went and wrote a letter to my dad. Went and wrote a letter to that man. Never thought I'd talk to him again. Went and wrote a letter to him at his grave. Read it to him. This is the kind of things we get to do to be free today. You know, this is the kind of stuff we get to do. When I was about 3 days before I turned a year, I get a phone call from Shelbyville, Tennessee, and it's my son. He's 12. And he says, my mom's dead. My mom's dead. She wasn't one of the lucky ones that got what I got today. She died from this disease. This program allowed me to go get my son and be a man and walk through that with him. And my sponsor guided me every step of the way to get up there and get this boy. He's been with me now for about 2 years, it'll be 2 years in April. I have full custody of him today. So you guys and gals that don't have your kids tonight, do the work. Do the work. Because it's out there. It's a freeing process when you go do the work and get your kids. I have a relationship with my oldest one that I never had. I can remember going to my oldest one, and it was one of those 9 days, and my ex-wife called me and said, "Do you want to come see Tyler Pitts?" He was 18, one of the star pitchers in Briarcrest in Memphis. "He's coming to Chattanooga. You think you could be there on a Friday?" You know, it talks about in the book, we get tight at the right times. I got real good and tight. Got about halfway Chattanooga, turned around. But through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and working these 12 steps, I got to go back and see him pitch his senior year. Start building a relationship with my kids. Start building a relationship with my family members, my sister, my mom. Friends that I've never had in my life exist because of this program. You know, I'm going to talk, you know, it talks about 10, 11, and 12. You know, 10 is where I get to work on myself every day. 11 is where I get to work with God every day. 12 is where I get to work with others, and that's where it's at. When I get to work with another man, and see how light go off in his eyes that it did go off in mine, it's better than any high I've ever experienced. But, you know, in sobriety, I got to tell on myself a little bit. You know, after working in the 12 Steps with Alcoholics Anonymous and being a sponsor, you know, I still was working towards building that relationship with God. And my boy Gene and my boy Larry Scott is not here tonight. You know, saw me go through some tough times because I was filling it with Harleys. I was filling it with trucks. And I was filling it with women. And all I was trying to do was fill that void. And another one of my favorite lines in the book is, "The elimination of my drinking is but a beginning. The more demonstration of these principles comes before before you in occupations, homes, and all your affairs." And that's where I try to live today. And so, going to We're Not a Glum Lot was my home group for a long time. And I started learning how to pray again. And I started learning how to respect women again. And learning what that meant. Because I didn't know what that meant all my life. I knew how to respect and treat them like they're supposed to be treated as one of God's kids. And I can tell you, the lady that introduced me right here, God brought me to her. God brought her to me. You know, I never did believe in soulmates my whole life, but I've got a soulmate. I've got a partner. I've got a true best friend today. I never had that when I was out there drinking and drugging. I never had that. I've got the most beautiful wife in the world, and I learn how to respect her, and I treat her like the lady she is every day. This is what this program is about, you guys. Doing the work. You know, I emphasize doing the work because until I did the work, I couldn't have what I've got today. And I continue doing the work because I got an internal trash can that needs to be dumped a lot. So don't cut yourself short in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do the work. Get you a competent sponsor. It takes you through the 1 through 164 and takes you through the steps as it's designed to do in the book. You know, I'm going to wrap this up talking about one thing. You know, my buddy Thomas, who's now in Indonesia, and he's a guy that I truly respect, and he lived with me for quite some time. Well, about the first 6 months, went through step studies together and book work together. And he taught me one thing about, you know, I remember, and I related to this so well. Some of you guys may have heard me talk about this, but I was a big paint-by-numbers guy when I was little. because I was always wanting to be an artist, but I can't draw worth a shit. But those paint-by-numbers allowed me to color a pretty damn nice picture. And so I always stuck with it. And so Thomas had told me, and this is what I relate to you guys, is this program of alcoholics, because if you stay within the steps, life's pretty good. If you get outside these steps and start living your own life, in your own way, and don't have that guidance, and don't work, and life gets pretty messed up. So I call it spirituality by the numbers. That's what I got today. And I appreciate you guys having me, and thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Marty, thank you so much. You spoke the truth. I like it. Thank you.
from this pain and misery. This pain and misery.